Support comes from Ohio University's Voinovich School of Leadership and Public Service, a proud member of Ohio University's Health Collaborative, with the Heritage College of Osteopathic Medicine and the College of Health Sciences and Professions. We are partnering with local providers and communities to improve public health. Information is available at ohio.edu/Voinovich-school.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Jazzed About Work, where we talk about everything that might have an impact on your career. I'm your host, Bev Jones, author of Find Your Happy at Work. And our guest today, Kim Scott, is an expert on how to create a happier, more respectful, and productive workplace. Kim is a consultant who helps leaders to encourage feedback, offer praise, and create more candid cultures. She's been an executive coach at tech firms like Dropbox and Twitter, and she was a member of the faculty at Apple University. Kim is also an author, and today we'll talk about her new book, Radical Respect, How to Work Together Better. It's all about creating organizations that support both belonging and individuality. And Kim will share some practical tips about how to deal with bias and bad behavior and how to promote an environment that allows everyone to flourish. Kim, thank you so much for being here today at Jazzed About Work. I really respect your new book, Radical Respect, How to Work Together Better. But it addresses so many things that bother us just about anybody who is working to create a very thriving workplace. So thank you for being here.
Thank you. I'm excited for our conversation.
You know, your new book I just mentioned is Radical Respect, but as I was reading a bit about it and reading a bit of it, it struck me that it's kind of hard to describe your book without mentioning your earlier book. So would you tell us how it is that you wrote your second book first, it seems
yes.
like?
Yeah.
And what caused you, tell us about the first book and then tell us what caused you to write this second one.
So it's a great question, because Radical Respect, my second book, is really kind of the prequel to my first book, which was called Radical Candor. And Radical Candor is the subtitle is Be a Kick-Ass Boss Without Losing Your Humanity. So it's all about how to create a working environment where we can all be jazzed about work. And at the core of Radical Candor is a 2x2 framework. And my assertion is that the essence to a good relationship between a boss or a manager or a leader and their direct report is radical candor. And radical candor is what happens when you care personally and challenge directly at the same time. So if you think about it in terms of a 2x2 framework, imagine a vertical line and that's labeled care personally, and a horizontal line and that's labeled challenge directly. When you do both, it's radical candor. When you challenge, but you don't care, and the bottom right-hand box is obnoxious aggression. And
yeah.
Obnoxious aggression, sometimes radical candor and obnoxious aggression get confused for one another. Sometimes I'll be working with a team, and somebody will charge into a meeting, and they'll say, in the spirit of radical candor, and then they will proceed to act like a garden variety jerk. And that is not the spirit of radical candor. That is the spirit of obnoxious aggression. And obnoxious aggression is a big problem. It's a problem because it hurts other people. It's also a problem because it's inefficient. If I'm obnoxious to you, but even more so, you know, if I'm your boss, which I am not, then you're likely to go into fight or flight mode, and then you literally cannot hear a word I say. So I'm wasting my breath. So it's inefficient. It's also a problem for a third reason, because Beverly, I don't know about you, but for me, when I realize I've acted like a jerk, which unfortunately we all do, once a day. Yeah. It's not my instinct to go the right way on the care personally dimension. Instead, it's my instinct to go the wrong way on challenge directly. And then I wind up in the worst place of all, the bottom left-hand quadrant, where I'm in what I call manipulative insincerity. This is where, yes, the passive aggressive behavior, political behavior, even something as innocuous as a false apology. Oh, I didn't really mean it, but I did mean it, you know? And that kind of behavior really destroys trust. It's hard to be jazzed about a workplace where you don't know when somebody's going to stab you in the back. So if obnoxious aggression is front stabbing, manipulative insincerity is backstabbing. And it's kind of fun to tell stories about these behaviors. When we talk about things going wrong at work, we often are talking about obnoxious aggression and manipulative insincerity. But the fact of the matter is, these are not the most common mistakes. The vast majority of people make the vast majority of their mistakes in this upper left-hand quadrant, where we do remember to show that we care personally, but we're so worried about not hurting someone's feelings or not offending them that we fail to tell them something they'd be better off knowing in the long run. And that is what I call ruinous empathy. So that's the old book in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I think it makes a lot of sense. It's harder to manage and create than one might think once you start trying. And so that brings you to some aha moments, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And that is what made me write Radical Respect, which is the prequel. Because, you know, if you don't respect someone, you're not going to care about them and you're not going to challenge them for sure. And so if you write a book about feedback, which Radical Candor very much was, you're bound to get a lot of it. And indeed, I did. And hands down, the most helpful feedback I got came when I was giving a Radical Candor talk at a tech company in San Francisco. And the CEO of that company had been a colleague of mine for the better part of a decade. She's a person who I like and respect enormously. And she's one of too few Black women CEOs in tech. And when I finished, because I'd worked with her for such a long time, I was especially excited to do this presentation at her company. And when I finished, she pulled me aside and she said, "Kim, I'm excited to roll out Radical Candor. I think it's going to help me build the kind of innovative culture that I want to build. But I got to tell you, it's much harder for me than it is for you." And she went on to explain to me that as soon as she would offer anyone even the most compassionate, gentle criticism, they would call her an angry Black woman.
Yes.
And as soon as she said this, I knew it was true. And I felt terrible in sort of four different ways at the same time. And of course, you know, my feelings were not the point. The point was what had happened to her over the course of her career. And so the first thing that I realized was that I had not been the kind of colleague that I want to be, that I imagine myself to be. I had been a silent bystander when this was happening to her instead of being the kind of upstander who intervenes. And I write a lot about what upstanders can do in Radical Respect.
And I just
had not taken into account the toll it must take on her to have to show up unfailingly cheerful and pleasant in every meeting we were ever in together, even though she had what to be ticked off about, right? And I think part of being jazzed about your work is being able to say when something's going wrong. And it was harder for her than for me. The second thing that I realized was that not only had I been in denial about the kinds of things that were happening to her as a Black woman in the workplace, I had also been in denial about the kinds of things that were happening to me as a white woman in the workplace. Kind of hard for the author of a book called Radical Candor to admit it, but I had pretended that a whole host of disrespectful attitudes and behaviors had not happened that had, in fact, happened. And I think I did that because I never wanted to think of myself as a victim. And I think a lot of us don't want to think of
ourselves. Yes, I was going to say that is, you are not alone, sister. There's a lot of that going around.
Yeah. And I don't want to give, you know, if you're early in your career and you're pretending that things aren't happening that are, like, I don't want to give you a hard time. It doesn't mean you're not courageous or that you're in denial or something like that. It's a coping mechanism. But over time, what I realized is that it was a bad coping mechanism for me because it was robbing me of my sense of agency. Now, there were two other things I realized, though. I didn't, it didn't end there. The third thing that I realized was that even less than wanting to think of myself as a victim, did I want to think of myself as a culprit. And so I had been most deeply in denial about the times when I was the one who had the disrespectful attitude or behavior that was making it harder than it needed to be for my colleagues to get their jobs done. And I think, you know, I don't know about you, Beverly, but it's so hard to recognize my own biases, my own bad behavior. And that was the thing that I probably struggled the most with when I wrote this book. And I tried to be candid about my mistakes in hopes that other people can learn the easy way by reading about what I had to learn the hard way by screwing up. And then the fourth thing that I realized was that as a leader, I imagined myself to be the kind of leader who created these BS-free zones where everybody could do the best work of their lives and build the best relationships of their careers. But by being in denial about these disrespectful attitudes and behaviors that were getting in the way of that, I was not living up to my own expectations for myself as a leader. So that was a big drink of water, but it also was sort of at the same time liberating because it's what made me realize I needed to sit down and write Radical Respect and think about what it is and what gets in the way and how to get it back out of the way.
Well, I think what you did with as you were creating Radical Respect, is you came up with a framework. So many of us have been engaged in the issues of prejudice and lack of dignity and, you know, all of the horrible things that can happen, sometimes quite accidentally in a workplace and sometimes with horrible intention.
Yeah.
We've been involved for a long time, but these issues are difficult to talk about. They're difficult to talk about even with your really close friends and colleagues who have a different perspective, a different life situation than you do. And having a framework, having a way to kind of sort things out, I think is something really useful if you want to move forward on the continuing effort to create organizations where everybody's treated with support and respect. So I have a couple of questions. First, just quickly define or give us your definition of respect for purposes of this book and the content we're talking about. And then I want to get into some of those three things that can get in the way of respect. But what do you mean by respect?
Yeah, so respect has two definitions. Words are very confusing. I spend a lot of time writing, as I imagine you have too throughout your career. One definition of respect is something that we have to earn. So I have to earn your respect for me as a writer by writing. You can't just give that to me automatically. That's not what I'm talking about. The second definition of respect is what I'm talking about. It's this unconditional regard that we owe each other really for our shared humanity and for each other's emotions, for our backgrounds, for who we really are. And that kind of unconditional respect is so important. I can disagree with you. You can disagree with me. You can hold me accountable for mistakes I've made and give me that kind of unconditional respect at the same time. And that's what I want us to do together at work. And I think, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I love a good 2x2 framework. And so the 2x2 framework for radical respect is you've got to optimize for collaboration rather than coercion. So on the vertical axis is collaboration on top. That's what you're aiming for, and what you're avoiding is coercion. I think hierarchy is a fact of life in most workplaces, but you can have a collaboration hierarchy. You don't have to have a dominance hierarchy, and I think that's really important. And then on the horizontal axis is honoring individuality rather than demanding conformity. And so when you can optimize for collaboration and honor individuality at the same time, you get radical respect. You get the kind of team where the strength of the team comes from the individual and the strength of the individual comes from the team. You get the best of both worlds. And that's why I love the 2x2. We want the best of both worlds, not the worst or not, you know, half as good.
I like the graphic of it.
Yes, it's helpful, right? Because when you're in the moment and something, I mean, and I'm sure that you've had this multiple times a day, everybody listening has had a moment in a meeting in the last day where something happened, something kind of cringeworthy happened, and you didn't know what to say, or you didn't even know how to think about what it was. And then, so you defaulted to silence. I mean, I do it all the time as well, even though I wrote the book and recommend that we not do it. It's very instinctive. And then it wakes you up at 3 a.m. and when you need to be sleeping. So hopefully what I'm about to say will help us through those moments so that we can figure out what to say. Because I think even though we all want and expect, like I started a software company back in 2000. And part of the reason why I started this company is, and this is an embarrassing confession, but I thought that if I was the founder and CEO of the company, all this other disrespectful BS that had happened to me at other places I had worked wouldn't happen to anyone just because I was in charge, which of course is not.
You must have been very young then.
I was very young. I was very, but I think even pretty seasoned leaders have this imagination that in organizations that they run, people won't behave like people, but of course they do behave like people. And a really important lesson I learned is that if you don't design your systems to be fair, then you're going to get this kind of, you're going to get these problems. You're going to get systemic injustice. So what gets in the way of radical respect? There's a million things, but I'm going to boil it down to three. You ready for the framework?
Yes, please.
Okay. So there's three big things: bias, prejudice, and bullying. And I think that one of the problems here is that we often conflate bias, prejudice, and bullying as though they are the same thing, but they're actually three different things. So if we're trying to solve a hard problem, where do you start? You break it down into its component parts and you take it one at a time, bird by bird. And so I want to offer some perhaps overly simple but super short definitions of bias, prejudice, and bullying. Bias is not meaning it. I'm really talking about unconscious bias here. Whereas prejudice is meaning it. Prejudice is a very consciously held belief, usually incorporating some kind of unfair and inaccurate stereotype. And bullying is just being mean. So bias, not meaning it. Prejudice, meaning it. Bullying, being mean. Bullying is not about a belief. It's about kind of the will to dominate, if you will. And so given that, how can we respond to these very different things? And by the way, the framework makes it seem so simple and it's 100% clear what's what. But of course, in the moment, you're not sure what's happening. But let's say you think it's bias, and you don't have to be sure. I recommend if you think it's bias to start with an I statement, whereas if you think it's prejudice to start with an it statement, and if you think it is bullying to start with a you statement. So,
well, give us an example of that.
Yeah, here's some examples. One of my favorite stories about dealing with bias, how an upstander, by the way, dealt with bias, comes from a friend of mine who went into a meeting with two colleagues who were men. She had the expertise that was going to win her team the deal. So she sat at the center of the table and her two colleagues sat off to her left. When the other side came in, who they were negotiating with, the first person came and sat across from the guy to her left. The next person sat across from the guy to his left. And then everybody else filed on down the table, leaving her dangling by herself as though she were the note taker. Ever noticed that happened in a meeting?
Yes.
Yeah. And when she started talking, the other side, first of all, they seemed surprised. And then when they had questions, they directed them at her two colleagues who were men. Ever seen that happen? Probably so.
Yes.
So it happened once. It happened twice. It happened a third time. And finally, one of her colleagues stood up and he said, "I think we should switch seats." That was all he had to do to totally change the dynamic in the room. The other side realized what they were doing, and they stopped doing it. They started engaging with her. And he decided that he needed to be an upstander in that moment for several reasons. One was practical. He wanted to win the deal, and he knew that they wouldn't win if the other side wouldn't listen to her. Two was sort of emotional. He liked her, and it bothered him that she was getting ignored. The third was sort of efficiency-based slash giving maybe some compassion for the people who were making the biased mistake. He knew that it was going to be easier for them to hear it from him than from her. And so he decided it made sense for him to speak up. It wasn't that he thought she couldn't speak up for herself, but he thought it would be easier for them to hear it from him. And then the fourth reason was really sort of self-preservation, because he knew if he didn't say anything, he was going to wake up at 3 a.m. kicking himself for not having said anything. So that's like a simple story. I think we should switch seats and it solved the problem. No big thing. However, if it is, and that I think is the benefit, by the way, of the I statement. It sort of holds up a mirror for the other person to understand the situation from your perspective. However, if it's prejudice and not bias, holding up a mirror is not going to work, because the other person is going to look in that mirror and smile. They're going to like what they see.
They already know.
Yeah, they believe that thing. It's not going to do any good to point out what they consciously believe. So here's a story about that. This happened to me shortly after I returned to work after maternity leave. I had given birth to twins and taken my 5 months and I'd just gone back to work. 2 days after going back, I was chit-chatting with a guy before a meeting started. And he said to me, "Oh, my wife doesn't work because it's better for the children." And for me at that moment, that was like a gut punch. But I didn't think he really meant it. I thought this was sort of unconscious bias. So I tried an I statement and I said, "Oh, I decided to show up at work today because I wanted to neglect my children." And I was expecting to have your reaction, to kind of chuckle and apologize and we would move on. But no, that's not what happened. He said, "Oh no, Kim, I have all this research. I want to give it to you. It's really not good that you're working." And so now I know it's prejudice, not bias. And the I statement didn't work because he doubled down. And so now I know I need an it statement. An it statement can appeal to the law, it can appeal to a company policy, or it can appeal to common sense. So I chose the company policy and I said, "Look, it is an HR violation for you to tell me that I am neglecting my children by showing up at work today." And that had the desired impact. He sort of looked alarmed and backed off. And then I decided to follow up with an it statement appealing to common sense. And I said, "Look, it is my decision together with my husband how we raise our children, just as it is your decision together with your wife how you raise yours. Like, this is not a work matter." And I could tell that he didn't quite agree. And so I went a little bit further and I said, "Look, I'm not going to make a thing of this with HR, but I'm guessing it's the case that you don't want to read my research any more than I want to read your research." And then he kind of laughed. And you know, I don't think that solved all the world's problems, but we were able to work together better because I said something. If I had not said anything, I would have kind of started to hate the guy, and it would have been really hard to work with him. So it was important for our relationship and also for the quality of our work for me to talk to him. And I think it's important, by the way, to try to talk to people before you go get help from HR. I'm not saying you should never go, but try to work it out directly first. Now, so that's bias and prejudice. What about bullying? An it statement is not going to work if someone is trying to bully you, because you know that when a person is in that mode, they're going to kick past any boundary you see. Like, the it statement shows the boundary between one person's freedom to believe whatever they want, but they can't impose that belief on others. But since bullying is not about a belief, you know, you're wasting your breath to discuss the thing, and they're going to push past whatever law or policy that you might put in that might be in place. So in the case of bullying, you want a you statement. And my daughter actually taught me this when she was in third grade. She was getting bullied on the playground, and I was encouraging her to use an I statement to tell this child, you know, I feel sad when you blah, 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 blah. And my daughter banged her fist on the table and she said, Mom, they are trying to make me feel sad. Why would I tell them they succeeded? And I'm like, oh,
yes.
Yeah. Really good point.
Very wise.
Yes, very wise.
Well, bullying is something that we see all the time, even in surprising places, even in well-run organizations. There can be prejudice that's part of it, but lots of times it's not about that. It's about the mean person. So
yeah, yes.
I think that everybody needs to have skills for grappling with bullying, whether you're a leader or a upstander who's trying to help a colleague, or you're struggling with it yourself. You had a five ways to, or I guess five aspects of grappling with bullying. Would you share those? I bet there's somebody listening out there who could use that information today.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you notice one person bullying another person and you want to intervene in some way, you want to be an upstander, you don't want to be a silent bystander, there's a bunch of different things you can do. One thing is you can intervene directly, like the guy in the story who said, I think we should switch seats, where you're confronting the person. In that case, it was bias, not bullying, but where you're confronting the person quite directly. But maybe you can't think of what to say, or maybe you feel like you're the wrong person to do that, or maybe you think that it'll make the situation even worse for the person who's being harmed by the bullying if you confront it directly. So another thing you can do is you can delay. And you can think of this as 5 D's. So the first is direct, the second is delay. And by delay, what I mean is you can check in with the person who was the target of the bullying after the event. And this can really have a big impact. I will tell you a simple story about a time when I was giving a talk to a big team, a couple thousand people, and the vice president who managed that team introduced me and my two colleagues. So he introduced my first colleague, shook his hand, introduced my second colleague, shook his hand, introduced me, and I stuck my hand out for him to shake it, and he grabbed it and kissed it, like leaving a bunch of slobber on the back of my hand. Kind of a gross moment. That was, you know, a small form of bullying, I thought. But that wasn't the worst thing. What was worse was that nobody, not a single one of those thousands of people who saw that happen, came up to me afterwards and said, that was weird. Do you want some hand sanitizer or whatever?
Uh-huh.
And that then left me feeling gaslit. I was wondering, like, was I the only person who thought that was off? And so it can be incredibly valuable to the person who was harmed by the bullying behavior to just check in with them later. The third thing you can do is you can delegate. Maybe you think you're not the right person, but there are other upstanders in the room. Catch someone else's eye and make sure that they know that you're putting the onus on them. You both notice this thing and you're asking them to be the one to intervene. It can be helpful sometimes. The fourth technique is to create a distraction. So we've got 4 D's, direct, you can delay, you can delegate, you can distract. And this can be as simple as spilling your cup of coffee. Sometimes just creating a distraction can get the bully's attention and give the person who's being bullied a chance to regain their composure. And then the fifth thing, of course, that we can always do is document. We're all carrying around these movie cameras in our pocket. So document what is happening. But remember, you don't own that document. And you can also write about it. You don't have to film it. But you don't own the documentation. The person who is harmed owns the documentation. They get to figure out what to do about it. So those are just some things that we can do to be better upstanders, to intervene when we notice somebody getting bullied. Because it's hard to be, you sort of suffer a moral injury if you're a silent bystander.
I think it's really important that everybody be prepared to be an upstander, to be willing to step in sometimes. And one of the reasons you mentioned in the book, and I so agree with it, you know, as a coach, I hear from a lot of executive type folks and professionals of all sorts about what they worry about. And one of the things that happens when people are bullying and decide, I'm just going to deal with it because it's not worth the effort and, you know, this will end soon, or bias or prejudice, very often the victim says, I'm not going to treat myself like a victim. And then when they wake up at 3 a.m, they think, oh, but do I owe it to my peers? Do I owe it to other people? Just because I can deal with it. Do I have an obligation every time this happens? Do I have to be the one to fight it? And I think what you're saying is no, the victim shouldn't carry the burden. That the victim has choice and the rest of us should provide support. Is that
Exactly right. If we go back to those four realizations I had after my colleague told me it was harder for her to roll out radical candor than for me, one was that I had failed to intervene as an upstander. So upstanders have an obligation to intervene, whereas people who are harmed get to choose their response. Yeah. And I think the important thing about choosing, and very often I think we add injury, insult to injury. So something bad happens to me and I choose not to respond. And then I wake up at 3 a.m. and I'm giving myself a hard time for being a coward or something. And I wasn't a coward. I just chose my battle. But I think the important thing is to make sure you make a proactive choice. Don't default to silence. And I think, remember, what Audre Lorde said is true. Your silence will not protect you. Silence feels safer than speaking up, but there are pros and cons to both being silent and to speaking up. And so do a little mental return on investment. Is it worth it to you or not? And you get to choose. I can't tell you what the right thing to do is. But sometimes we're the leader. And as a leader, I think we have an obligation to actually take steps to prevent these things from happening, to prevent bias, prejudice, and bullying from getting in the way of radical respect on our teams. And that means that you need to create bias disruptors. You need to make sure that your team understands the it statement, where that line is between one person's freedom to believe whatever they want, but they can't impose it on others. And you need to create consequences for bullying. And then last but not least, what do we have to do when we're the person who was disrespectful, who had the disrespectful attitude or behavior? That, I think, I boil that down to an acronym, ACK. Because that's an easy thing to say in the moment, but the first, that's 5 A's and a C. So you want to be aware of what you did wrong. And that means sometimes we have to educate ourselves. It doesn't mean you have to put the burden of educating you on the person who you're harming. You know, it's your job to be aware. Ignorance is no excuse. And then the second thing that we need to do is we need to admit our mistakes. I think it's so easy to feel deeply ashamed when we realize that we've been biased or prejudiced or that we bullied someone. And often when we feel ashamed, we instinctively deny. So we need to, you know, learn how to acknowledge rather than deny. And part of that acknowledgement is being willing to accept the consequences. So that's the third A, is don't try, you know, there may be a consequence to you for your behavior. Just accept it and move on, because the, you know, the cover up is always worse than the original crime.
So absolutely. Learn from it.
Yeah. And then go ahead.
No, finish what you were saying.
And then the fourth A is around actually making amends. You want to go beyond the basic consequences, but you want to do more than you have to do. And only after you've done those four things does an apology have any meaning. And then the C in ACT is change. work to change. You may not be, sometimes it's like a small thing, a deeply ingrained pattern of speech that you can't necessarily change as soon as you become aware of it, but you got to keep working to change it. You got to be patient with yourself, but also persistent.
At the beginning of our conversation, you alluded to the creepiness of false apologies.
Yes.
So I think one thing to take away from your book and from our discussion is that false apologies never help. They don't buy you anything. From that, your fakeness doesn't in any way take care of your situation, and they never help the person you're offering them to. So if nothing else, in a situation like this, we get back to candor. You have to acknowledge where you are and be honest.
Yes, yes. And if you don't know what you did wrong, which is sometimes the reason why people make a false apology, it is become aware of why this other person is upset. And that's a real, there was one time when I was giving a talk and a participant raised their hand and pointed out something I had said. And left the room in tears. And now I was, first of all, ashamed because I had hurt her, but I was even more ashamed because I was ignorant. I didn't know what was wrong with what I had said. And I, in that moment, moved too quickly to apologize. And instead, what I wish I had done is paused and confessed, said, I don't even know. I know I did something wrong just there. I don't even know what it was. And I'm going to do everything that I need to do to find out why what I said was so upsetting. Because that was, my intentions don't matter. What matters is that I've hurt someone. And so moving too fast to apology, what was I really trying to do, if I'm honest with myself? I was just trying to get away from the situation and continue with my talk. And that was the wrong thing for me to have done.
Well, your book is full of good suggestions, and also good suggestions based on your own learning path, I would say.
Experience.
It makes it a more interesting book to read, but it's full of good practical tips. So I just want to repeat the name again. The full title is Radical Respect, How to Work Together Better. I like that title. And of course, your other book is Radical Candor. And I think people who are dealing with these issues of getting past bad behavior in the workplace would find them to be very helpful. So I really appreciate your being with us today, Kim. And I think you're doing good work out there.
Well, thank you so much. You are doing great work out there. It is so important. Work can be traumatizing, or it can heal us from trauma. So let's create the kind of workplaces where we can be jazzed about our work.
I think we're agreed on that. I hope you all have a wonderful day out there.
Take care.
Today, we've been talking with Kim Scott about creating more respectful and candid work environments. This podcast is produced by WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our audio engineer. I'm your host, Beverly Jones, author of Find Your Happy at Work. And our sponsor is the Voinovich School of Leadership and Public Service at Ohio University. today's tip is that if you want to thrive in your career and make friends along the way, look for opportunities to create collaboration, including with people who are not at all like you. Thanks for listening, and if you enjoyed today's show, please come back soon.